The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
How did Love Canal influence your decision to walk the length of the pipeline?
I think that had just kind of settled into my subconscious at a very early age. I mean, having grown up just 4 miles from one of the worst environmental tragedies in U.S. history, it kind of just tells you what happens when industry gets to do it its own way. So when I heard about what was happening up in the tar sands, where they're polluting pristine rivers, where they're destroying millions of acres of boreal forest, and where a lot of the nearby native populations are experiencing abnormally high cancer rates, much the same way that my town folks were back in the 1970s, I didn't think of the tar sands and what the Keystone XL represented as some faraway exotic place, but just another home, someone else's home, set to be destroyed the same way my hometown was.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Ken Ilgunis about his trek across the proposed route of the Keystone XL pipeline and the book he wrote about his adventures, which is titled Trespassing Across America, One Man's Epic, Never Done Before, and Sort of Illegal, Hike Across the Heartland. Well, before we get into some of the issues and details related to your long trek, let's walk through the bullet points. You began in Hardisty, Alberta, Canada, and your first big adventure involved a bull moose.
That's right. Yeah. So, first of all, just to hike the Keystone XL pipeline, I couldn't follow roads because pipelines don't follow roads. They don't like roads. They like to go across country. They like to cross croplands and grasslands and private property. So to hike the Keystone XL, I'd have to essentially trespass across North America. And for the first 2 days up in central Alberta, the pipe kind of paralleled a road. So I was just a road walking for those first 2 days. And then on day three, I had to hop a barbed wire fence and start trespassing to keep following this pipe. And within the first hour of trespassing, on my first day of trespassing, I saw this big brown butt in the woods. And, you know, this was like rolling grasslands. You kind of would think it would be a horse, and that's what I thought. So I walked up to it, and it turned out the horse had antlers, and it came out of the woods and started chasing me. And I took off on a sprint. Well, it was hardly a sprint. It was more like an awkward shuffle with my 45-pound pack, taking off towards this cluster of woods, hoping some, you know, my ancestors were monkeys, tree climbing instincts would just like instantaneously kick in. Luckily, it didn't come to that. But after that day, it was just like, man, I don't know if I can do this if this is happening this early on. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get to Texas.
During one of the 13 days you spent walking across Saskatchewan, you had to fall to the ground and cower while people were shooting guns.
Yeah, that was an unusual situation. So what happened was I was walking grasslands. I didn't properly like scout out the area before I set up my tent. And just up the hill was this gravel road, which, and you know, I hadn't seen gravel roads that whole day. So I set up my tent and I'm laying in there and this car comes rolling by and I'm like, oh crap. And they get out and I hear the doors slam and it's just a bunch of young dudes and they start talking about their shotguns with an ardor, which I think is like unacceptable for anything other than, you know, like your lover. But so then they started just firing over the prairie, over my tent, and I'm just cowering in my tent. I don't know if I should, you know, get out and bellow, hello, you know, I'm here, or if I should just kind of stay hidden. Anyways, they drove off and I just dragged myself and my tent into this shrubbery and just laid there in the woods with, you know, little birds and little mice waiting for them to go away.
You spent 17 days walking through Montana, through the eastern part of Montana, spent some time in Glasgow, walked down to Broadus. What did the people in Montana think of your trip and of you?
First of all, let me preface by saying that the people of Montana and, you know, the heartland and the Great Plains, they were really nothing but kind and generous, and they were trying to take care of this complete stranger, me, whenever they saw me. There was a couple prickly people I came across. It was funny, like in Canada, I was trespassing and I talked to folks about it and it just wasn't a big deal. But once I crossed the border into Montana, pretty much every day I got called crazy and people prophesized that I was going to get shot that very day. So it was a slightly different mentality, but overall, really nothing but kindness.
What about the day where the three guys came and woke you up?
You're speaking of the posse.
Yes.
Yeah. So I forget where exactly I was in the state at that point, but I was walking some grasslands, and it was getting to be that time of evening where I wanted to set up my tent for the night. And I was also out of water, so I walked up to this rancher's home, and this young man was out there, and he had a pistol with a barrel that was so long, like right around his hip. And I knew that he must have heard from someone else that I was in the area, because there's just no way you would carry a gun like that around you, you know, when you're doing just general ranching duties. And he was very nervous when I asked him for water. And normally I'd just lay on the charm as best I could. And that often put people at ease, but it just wasn't working with this guy. And I just asked, you know, where can I camp? And he just said, oh, down the road, wherever you want, just to, you know, get me away from his property. So I set up my tent, I don't know, a mile or so down the road next to this creek on some grassland. And in the morning, I wake up to a sheriff's voice. He says, good morning, this is the sheriff. And I get out of my tent and I'm surrounded by three guys. At least one of them is armed. Presumably all of them were. And they just all had steely glares. you know, at that point, I was just playing the best card I had, which was just like this, please don't shoot me, self-deprecating submission. And I, you know, just trying to make fun of myself. They're like, we just came out here to make sure you weren't crazy. And I was like, you got to be crazy to be doing something like this. And one of the older gentlemen kept saying, what you're doing, it's strange. It's strange. No one comes walking out here. What you're doing, it's strange. He kept saying that. And I was like standing innocently next to my tent, but he spoke as if I was like oiling myself up for a satanic ritual or something. And he said, you know, just don't trespass. And I think I probably obeyed that for about 10 minutes.
And we're going to talk about trespassing in the United States and other parts of the world a little bit later. But during the 20 days you walked through South Dakota, you wrote about being chased by cows. And I'm sorry to be laughing, but I have to say that as a former resident of eastern Montana and western North Dakota, where I spent probably a decade interacting with cattle, it seemed like your fear of cows was unreasonable. Where did this come from?
it may seem on the surface unreasonable, but let me give you a little context. You know, I grew up in a suburb outside of Buffalo, New York, never touched a cow, never been near a cow, never milked a cow. And, you know, I knew they were bigger than me and faster than me and had horns and gored bullfighters and chased people through Spain. So, yeah, I was a little nervous about walking past thousands and thousands of them. Like, what if one of them's having a bad day? But this relationship with the cows certainly evolved over the hundreds of miles I walked the route of the proposed Keystone XL. And by the time I got to South Dakota, my fear had just vanished. You know, they all react the same way. One pokes its head up, stares at you. The whole herd stares at you. One runs away. Then the whole herd runs away. But in South Dakota, I hopped this barbed wire fence, which I did like 50 times a day. And this herd wasn't running away. They just kind of stood there and I kept walking towards them because, you know, it was kind of just bluffing. And all of a sudden, I'm surrounded by cows and they start charging me down this gentle slope. And I drop my pack and I run like I've never run before. And when I tell my rancher friends who I've made in Nebraska, they just laugh at me, and say, oh, they were just curious. But at that moment, I was terrified for my life. When you have 20 black Angus cows flank to flank charging down a hill. Yeah, I think it's legitimate to be a little scared. And while I'm writing this book, I did a ton of goofy research on like barnyard animal fatalities. And I learned that 14 Americans die every year from cows. That's probably more in like pens and bulls and stuff like that. But still, bad stuff can happen.
Well, I guess you had to be wary. I was just thinking they probably thought you had something for them to eat and they wanted to be first in line.
But that's right. Yeah, that's what my rancher friends say.
And you spent 20 days walking across Nebraska, which was the only state in which you were forced into a police car and the guy wanted you out of the county.
That's right. Yeah. Petersburg, Nebraska. At that point, I was walking roads and, you know, I hadn't been trespassing for a few days. And I was just taking a break in this gas station, having a banana and some yogurt. And I looked over my shoulder and there was a deputy standing. And I was like, you know, how's it going? He says, I got to ship you out of the county. And I'm like, for what? And he says, get in the patrol car and I'll tell you. So he put me in his patrol car. I'm surrounded by cage. And he says, I got two calls from locals. And those locals remembered locking the doors, but when they got home, they were unlocked and their dogs had been let out. So I was being accused of being the dog liberator of Petersburg, Nebraska. And yes, I did this 1,700-mile hike, except for the 17 miles in which I was shipped out of Boone County, Nebraska.
And your travail with dogs continued into Oklahoma.
That's right. Well, first of all, it was fascinating to watch the character of the dogs change from north to south. Like Alberta, Montana, Nebraska, these are just big, overweight, sleepy Labradors. But when I crossed the border into Oklahoma, it was something else entirely. These dogs were just savage, like often of aggressive breeds like pit bulls and Rottweilers. And while I know there's a lot of friendly dogs of those breeds, when they're ill-treated and just kind of left to their own devices, they can be really menacing. So literally every day in Oklahoma, I was being chased by dogs. And I carried this big canister of bear spray with me. And normally I kept it in just kind of like the bottom of my backpack because I never needed it. But in Oklahoma, I had that thing in my hand with the cap off, ready to go any second.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, and I'm talking with Ken Elgunis about his trek across the proposed route of the Keystone XL pipeline and the book he wrote about it, Trespassing Across America. You can listen to this conversation again or share it with a friend at our blog or podcast. Links to both are at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook and Twitter pages. When we return, Ken will tell us more about why he walked so far and read a couple of short passages from the book. Don't go away. Thank you. the idea to walk the pipeline happened when you were working a job up in Alaska, and I'd just like you to read one short passage that talks about that.
Of course. Dead Horse Camp is a steely, rectangular Halliburton housing unit that runs entirely on diesel fuel. I worked alongside four coworkers, all my age, cooking and cleaning for about 50 oilfield workers who stayed at our camp. Oddly enough, three of us had college degrees in English, a degree that clearly did nothing to prepare us for the duties of succeeding in the professional world, but did, however, empower us to have impassioned 45-minute conversations about whether the film Scream does or does not fit within the horror genre. I was given one side of a red and white outdoor Travco trailer that was outfitted with giant skis so it could be dragged over the ice in winter. The manager encouragingly referred to it as my writing studio, but the desk, which had been glued to the wall decades before, fell off the moment I placed my laptop on it. Coworkers shared the communal shower with the tourists and pipeline workers. Because, as we were told, water cost 35 cents a gallon, it was no surprise that the water flowed from the shower nozzle at an exasperating dribble. The water pressure being so slight, I had to stand directly beneath it. Whenever I turned to wash a different part of my body, I'd accidentally nudge the hot-cold dial, which was hypersensitive, so much so that a millimeter adjustment to the left or right would send either a boiling, skin-melting trickle onto my shoulders or a polar, heart-stopping slush. I didn't mind my accommodations at all. In fact, I was plenty amused with the novelty of the camp and its eccentric drabness, but the work was depressing. I'd come into the kitchen at 6 p.m., the dish shift, and scrub the bottoms of burnt soup pots, dip my hand into sink drains to pluck out handfuls of slippery vegetables, and cram heavy black industrial trash bags into polar bear-proof dumpsters. I'd set up the salad bar, slice the bread, arrange the dessert rack, fold used cardboard, and clean up the kitchen for a morning cook. There once was a time when I was a student, a park ranger, an adventurer. And now look at me, dishwasher.
It seemed the situation was just ripe for you to decide you needed an adventure, and you and Liam came up with this idea to walk the pipeline, but then he dropped out. Why did you think it was such a good idea?
Yeah, let me just kind of explain kind of like where I was at in life. You know, I was 28, I was broke, I was washing dishes in very possibly the most miserable place on earth, and when you're 28 and broke and washing spoon after spoon in the middle of the night in a silent kitchen 300 miles north of the Arctic Circle, you can't help but question the direction your life is headed in. And I think I was just, I felt so purposeless. My life had so little meaning. I had so little to show for my 28 years. I was just very susceptible to inspiration. I was susceptible to grand ideas, to get out of there and do something with my life. And this was happening right at a time when the Keystone XL was in the news. This was back in 2011. Keystone XL was in the news all the time back then. When Liam, the cook next to me, suggested we hike the Keystone XL, I dropped my pan into the sink and looked at him with what must have been this frightening excitement and said, "We must."
You described yourself as a bit of an environmentalist. As you were out there walking and seeing the pipeline and seeing the people who wanted the pipeline, how did that change how you thought about the pipeline?
Yeah, I certainly came into this project with strong prejudices against the Keystone XL, but I also came into the project with the self-awareness that, you know, I didn't know anything about the Great Plains. I didn't know anything about the landowners' lives out there. I didn't know all that much about pipelines. So even though I had this prejudice, I wanted to go into this project with as much of an open mind as I could. And I wanted to get their opinions. I wanted to get their thoughts. So when I'm walking over Alberta and Saskatchewan and talking to the folks out there, and they're very in favor of the pipe because the pipe brings them a little money, gives the local economy a boost. You know, typically pipelines don't have, you know, wild gushing geysers. So I kind of just absorbed all that, and it made me sympathetic to them for sure. In the end, it by no means changed my opinion on the pipe, despite it being beneficial to some, because the pipe was connected to a rather destructive industry that was in the process of putting our planet in peril. So yeah, $10,000 isn't worth what this pipeline will do. And the other thing that got to me was the job thing. TransCanada, the pipeline company, kept claiming over and over again that they were going to create 20,000 jobs as a result of this pipeline, which was just ridiculous. You know, I walked several hundred miles of pre-existing pipeline routes, and guess how many workers I saw out there? I saw zero, because once these pipelines are in the ground, there's no more jobs. The State Department had projected 35 permanent jobs for the Keystone XL. So once these things are in the ground, there's not many jobs at all. The oil, much of it is sent overseas, so a lot of it doesn't wind up in our cars and planes. And having seen the tar sands of northern Alberta and being concerned about climate change, it was a no-brainer. This pipeline was a stupid idea.
You wrote, quote, "The last thing we need is more oil. We need, rather, different consumption habits, a whole new relationship with the world." What does that relationship look like to you?
Well, I think we are a very anthropocentric people. Many folks don't really view mankind as part of an ecosystem, part of a larger whole, but rather separate from it. I think to get to where we need to be, we really do need a stronger conservation and environmental ethic. We need to get to a point where being an environmentalist, which I think of as just someone who cares about the air and water and atmosphere, is not some extremist ideology, which a lot of the folks thought when I told them that it was environmentalist. No, I just care about other things. I think we need a new culture that embraces this. I think we need stronger religious institutions that emphasize this. The U.S. consumes, the U.S., Canada, and Australia consume twice the amount of energy that Europe does. We emit twice the amount of greenhouse gases as Europe does, and there's hardly any difference between our standard of living. So when I think about another giant pipe that would pump 830,000 gallons of tar sands oil every single day, it just seems like very backward thinking. Like, this is the time when we really need to be thinking about our consumption habits and our way of life.
You noted that farming out on the Great Plains is not sustainable. In fact, you wrote, quote, "It's the biggest ongoing ecological crisis that no one knows about." Can you give us in a nutshell the issues and why it's not sustainable?
Yeah, I mean, I've read some writers who've described the Great Plains agricultural industry as welfare farming. I mean, it requires a huge amount of government subsidies to keep it propped up because oftentimes it's not profitable. And of course, we all know about the dust storms of the 1930s. Trying to turn a terrain into cropland that wasn't ever meant to be. Right now, in various Great Plains states like Nebraska, they're relying on the Ogallala Aquifer to irrigate their crops. That's called fossil water because it's not really replenishable. So when I think about Great Plains agriculture, I think about unsustainability. And that's a general statement. Obviously, there's success stories. But as a whole, it does take a toll on the environment. And in Nebraska, there's this thing the farmers call $7 corn, which is great corn rates for the Corn Belt. They're making a lot of money. So they'll turn marginal grasslands that typically sandhills, it's very sensitive, it's historically not been used as cropland, and they'll turn that into cornfields. So we're losing all our native grasses, birds are losing habitat, and all the animals that dwell in them are really suffering. When you fly over a state like Nebraska, like eastern Nebraska, and you just see nothing but these circles where these pivots are circling and watering the crops, it's kind of a disturbing sight. This whole landscape has been transformed for the sake of industrial agriculture.
When I read what you wrote about the difference between walking in the U.S. and walking in Europe, I wanted to move to Scotland or Sweden.
Yeah, me too. This became a passion of mine. It's called the right to roam, because having trespassed across America, where you're constantly, you know, looking over your shoulder and in the back of your mind, it's like, I could probably get shot today. That just kind of makes you think about property and how we as a society think about property. So when I learned about the right to roam in several European countries, I got really intrigued. And the right to roam is a law. It's in countries like Scotland, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and several others, in which ordinary citizens, they have the freedom to walk over not just public land, but private land. So that's cropland, that's private forest. It's pretty much anywhere. Of course, there's some rules. They keep you away from homes. You have to stay like 70 yards from a home. You can't do any damage. You can go to prison if you do. But generally, you have a lot more freedom to walk and roam your country. And I think it's an absolute shame that we don't have that in America. You know, about 72% of America is privately owned. The other 28% is publicly. And even on those public areas like national parks, you're stuck to designated trails and designated campgrounds. So America, the so-called freest country on earth, you can't really walk anywhere.
Well, I'd like to just end with having you read another short passage, mm-hmm. the one that is at the bottom of page 140.
Every day there was a new trial. There was someone new to meet, something new to think, something new to learn, something new to see with every step, every turn. It was an infusion of newness. We weren't meant to be dishwashers, doing the same thing day in and day out. No, I knew from this sustained joy, this steady percolation of fulfillment, that we were meant for lives of variety, of novelty, of adventure. Immersed in this constant newness, when every step was exploratory, every interaction novel, and every day completely different from the previous, it was hard to think of ever going back to the dullness of the normal, the expected, the planned. Looking over the great white windy plains, I didn't think I was crazy. Rather, I thought that a life lived not half wild is a life only half lived.
Ken Ogunis lives in Benedict, Nebraska. Look for more information about him and his books, Trespassing Across America and Walden on Wheels, at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. You'll also find poems and children's book reviews there, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.